Aside from Afghanistan, President Obama faces an array of other foreign policy dilemmas. NPR's senior news analyst Daniel Schorr says there's one that needs Mr. Obama's full attention immediately.
During most of his 12 years as head of the United Nations Nuclear Watchdog Agency, Mohammed El-Baradei has striven to police Iran's atomic installations. Along the way, he won a Nobel Peace Prize. But when he recently stepped down, it was with a frustrated statement that he had reached a dead end. Iran has already been subjected to 3 sets of Security Council sanctions resolutions, and for denying access to a secret nuclear site, there may soon be a 4th, this time with Russian and Chinese support. But now the long-festering dispute seems to be heading towards measures beyond economic pressures. President Obama's invitation to Iran to join in friendly engagement seems forgotten now. The board of the International Atomic Energy Agency has rebuked Iran and demanded that it freeze uranium enrichment, expressing serious concern about potential military applications. Iran has figuratively thumbed its nose at the world body. President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad announced the launching of 10 new uranium processing sites. Iran probably lacks the capacity to build anything like that, but the announcement seems designed to evoke nationalist feeling. Backstage discussions have started at the United Nations looking towards some kind of punitive resolution, but economic sanctions seem not to do the trick anymore. Israel has served notice that it may feel obliged to use force if other measures fail. President Obama persuaded Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to allow time until the end of the year to work out a solution. But after that, all bets are off, and the Iran crisis may be entering a new and more threatening phase. This is Daniel Schorr.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Melissa Block. In western Massachusetts, on the banks of the Connecticut River, sits the town of Northampton. It's the hometown of writer Brian Keightley, and it's the setting for his new novel, The River Gods. Alan Chuse has this review.
River gods such as Israel Williams, 70 years old, in March of 1779, alternate chapters with members of novelist Keightley's own family, his grandfather, his parents, his gay brother, and various other inhabitants of Northampton. They speak in monologues, opening their minds and hearts to the reader, as might say, spirits at a séance, with the novelist as the inspired spiritualist. The result is an intense and beautiful collage of speeches in time about events in this one place, from the familiar and everyday to the divine. A 16-year-old Christian boy in the spring of 1738 says, "Molly and I do not deceive out of fear of discovery, or because it pleases us to, because we do no one harm, and because we enjoy accumulating venial sins." Jump forward to 1989, and the novelist himself chants the names of Northampton streets. First Square, Florence, Young Rainbow, Old Rainbow, Locust, Myrtle, Maple, Elm, Audubon, Evergreen. By this method, Northampton, Massachusetts, in this unlikely and memorable tribute to one writer's hometown, becomes everyone's location. The River Gods conjures up a local habitation by means of aesthetic magic. It's a meditation, a celebration, an investigation, and an elegy.
That's our reviewer, Alan Chuse. The new novel by Brian Keightley is called The River Gods.
And we're going to turn now to NPR science correspondent Richard Harris. President Obama travels to Copenhagen next week to work on an agreement to reduce greenhouse gases. Much of the world's scientific community agrees that the planet is warming and that human activity is responsible for at least part of that. But there are skeptics. The already politically charged controversy took on a new dimension in what some have dubbed ClimateGate. An unknown hacker posted scores of emails and documents from one of the world's premier climate research centers on the internet, and they suggest that mainstream scientists tried to quash research that challenged their views on global warming. And today that controversy reached Capitol Hill, and Richard Harris is here with us in Studio 3A. Nice to have you on, as always, Richard.
Pleased to be here.
And first of all, what are these emails about?
Well, there are thousands of them, and they are largely mundane science discussions. But there are a number of emails that have attracted a lot of attention, some that talk about that some of these scientists were so concerned about science that they didn't like being published, that they were trying to figure out if there was some way they could pressure journals not to publish some of these some of this research. Their explanation was it was bad research, and they didn't want it to be out in published literature where then people could hold it up and say, ah, but this paper says that global warming isn't real. And so it was sort of an attempt at an early intervention, but obviously it raises very serious questions about whether, you know, what's appropriate for the give and take in the world of science.
Well, again, the give and take in the world of science, normally, if a paper is published and people disagree with it, it sort of sinks without a trace.
That's right. And it does not happen in this case because it's such a politicized bit of science, the climate science. The vast majority of scientists do think this is a very real concern, that humans are largely responsible for it. But it's there's a real market for doubt because there are very powerful interests. The fossil fuel industry basically does not want to have to change the world, which essentially would be required if you accept what the majority of scientists say.
Well, now people have had to, I assume, take another look at this research, which might have been stifled or suppressed. And does it look any better given a second glance?
No, actually, today on Capitol Hill, John Holdren, who is a president science advisor, said, you know, he had one of the emails in there and he basically trashed one of these papers. And he said, I still think it was bad science. And I looked at it and I'm standing behind my belief that that was not good science. And so that's not the real issue is really has now arisen, and I think this may very well have been the intention of whoever leaked these emails, was to sow new doubt and to say, aha, look, these guys were maneuvering behind the scenes.
And so doubtful of their own position, they were quashing the opposition.
Yeah, and also there are occasions where they were, you know, maybe manipulating their own data. Now, scientists manipulate data all the time. That can have a negative connotation, or it can just mean, you know, that's how you make sense of data, is you manipulate it. So it is an open question from these emails whether the manipulation is appropriate. And again, John Holdren, the president's science advisor, says that's something that's worth looking into. Let's see what these guys were talking about in terms of manipulating their data and seeing if that was legitimate or illegitimate data manipulation.
So a lot of this is about the procedures at these journals where these papers are published, the politics of these journals, and there's scientific, there's internal arguments in every field, even in radio, I've heard tell.
Yes, I guess that's true. And clearly, there are scientists who are out there who are considered sort of either serious skeptics or quasi-skeptics who have complained to me about the fact that they have had really hard time getting stuff published in the literature. And they think, you know, it's hard to separate out how much is it just there's sort of personality stuff going on here. They're sort of on the outside, et cetera.
Well,
how
it's
much
also
is really,
access.
You know,
if they can't get papers published, they can't get access to funds.
That's right. That also can be a repercussion of this as well. And that's a serious concern.
And as this came up on Capitol Hill today, and there's going to be more on this when you do a story tonight for All Things Considered, and we're keeping him from his editing machine, and he's giving me dirty looks. But anyway, as this came up on Capitol Hill, clearly there you see the politicization side of this.
Absolutely. And already there are several calls for congressional investigations into this, and people, as expected, as predicted, some people who are sort of skeptical about climate change and the legislation that's designed to deal with climate change are saying, see, maybe we don't actually have to take this pain. Maybe it's all a fraud and we don't have to worry about it. And there were some very strong words exchanged on Capitol Hill about, you know, about this and a lot of doubt. I mean, fundamentally, congressmen, like the rest of us, don't understand the science very thoroughly, and they have to trust the messenger. And I think what they're seeing here is this is casting doubt on the messenger, and it leaves them a little bit confused about what to do.
And take the pain, because if you're going to reduce carbon emissions, well, that has economic impact.
Absolutely, it does. It's, basically, what you're talking about is ultimately phasing out fossil fuels in this globally, which is a very difficult thing to consider. On the other hand, you are also producing new industries that are clean energy industries. So there are winners and losers, and of course, the potential losers are fighting like heck not to lose, and that's sort of the source of the pain here.
We're talking about what's been dubbed ClimateGate with NPR science correspondent Richard Harris. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And this all plays into the controversy that's going to be developing when the president goes to Copenhagen and tries to, well, I think everybody has agreed ahead of time, there's not going to be a new agreement coming out of Copenhagen.
There will not be a formal legally binding agreement. The hope is that there will be some sort of political agreement out of Copenhagen. And I must say that these emails were sort of given the timing of the release of these emails, you have to wonder whether it was designed to screw up some of the discussions in Copenhagen. But I think that national academies of science from around the world do accept the reality of global warming. So I would be surprised if the emails have a huge impact on Copenhagen. But yeah, there are many, many huge issues that are going to be confronted in Copenhagen about figuring out what's equitable around the world to think about how to start phasing out fossil fuels.
And you see preemptive strikes. The four major developing nations today issued a statement saying, we're not going to go along with cutting this in half by 2050 and other proposals like that. You see, it was interesting, the leader of China, the president of China, agreeing to go to this meeting when it didn't look like he was going to go. President Obama, at some point, there was questions about whether he would attend, and now the Prime Minister of Canada, one day after saying he wasn't going to go, says he is going to go.
Yes, well, it is a lot of maneuvering going on. I think there's going to be high drama over the next couple of weeks at this meeting, and I think that there are really serious issues that I think are not going to get resolved in Copenhagen. They've already promised to continue these conversations in 2010, but you know it's hard if you don't even agree about what the shape of an agreement should be, and they don't have an agreement about that. It's hard to see how you're really going to, in a year's time, come up with a legally binding agreement.
Getting back to the discussion that was on Capitol Hill today, and that was partly about all of these different issues, but in any case, does this break down strictly on party lines?
Very much on party lines, not entirely, but it breakdowns partly on geographical lines too, because coal states are very concerned about what this means for their economies. Because obviously, if you are serious about doing something about climate change, you either have to stop burning coal entirely, or you have to make it much, much more expensive because you can burn it, but then you have to capture the carbon dioxide and bury it underground
before it's released.
Exactly. So it's partly geographic, but it's also very heavily partisan.
And there's also a lot of oil producing states as well.
That's true. Coal turns out to be a much bigger problem than oil, and that's where the focus is now. But yes, that absolutely comes in as well. And some of the oil-producing states are very upset about anything to upset their business.
But if you're opposed to the idea that man-made activities have caused global warming, why do you then go to the trouble of subsidizing things like alternative energies, wind turbines, all that sort of thing?
Yeah, well, there are other reasons you can still say it's a good idea. Freedom from foreign oil. We also are hearing about green jobs. And obviously, if you're producing a whole new generation of wind and solar industries in this country, and let's not forget efficiency, which is a very economical way to save energy, is get people to insulate their homes and so on, then all of a sudden you're creating new businesses of people who go in and install installation and you know, sell more efficient appliances, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a lot of, you know, in fact, some of these, the bills, the president rarely talks about climate change. He mostly talks about green jobs and energy security.
And as you come up on this issue, the ClimateGate debate on Capitol Hill, obviously the Democrats who, for the most part, support the consensus agreement that, yes, the world is warming, and yes, human activity is a significant part of that. Well, are they going to have support inquiries, congressional investigations into these emails, and what happens next?
I think you can't just turn your back on this and say it never happened. So I think there will have to be some investigations. There are already some getting underway. Maybe Congress is not the ideal organization to investigate this because it obviously gets into the technical weeds extremely quickly. But the question is how to pick a group of scientists to investigate that will come back with a trusted answer.
Richard Harris, thanks very much. And we thank you for taking time away from your editing for tonight's story.
My pleasure.
NPR science correspondent Richard Harris with us today in Studio 3A. Tomorrow, by the way, he will be back on this program as the president prepares for that climate summit in Copenhagen. He'll help us assemble a climate change reading list. What we should read to really understand this issue. If you have suggestions on that point, you can email us now. talk@npr.org is our email address. So Richard Harris, we'll see you here again tomorrow. Rebecca Roberts will be in this chair for that conversation. I will be in Jacksonville, Florida, visiting with our member station there, WJCT. So I'm Neil Conan. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Want even more talk? Head over to our blog at npr.org. There you can weigh in on the topics that landed on the cutting room floor, get a look at what's piquing our interest, and tell us what's caught your attention. You'll find it at the new npr.org/blogofthenation.
Okay, so opening a new restaurant is a risky business venture at any time. In Springfield, Missouri, two restaurants in the middle of this bad economy have found an unusual arrangement that's allowed one restaurant to stay afloat and made it possible for a new restaurant to open. Missy Shelton of member station KSMU has their story.
When you pull off the busy expressway near downtown Springfield and turn into the parking lot, you see two signs on the front of a beige building. One says Scramblers Downtown, the other says Andoro's Pizzeria. Timothy Williams manages the breakfast diner Scramblers, and he says the signage has been a source of confusion for customers.
For a while, people thought we were closing because we had signs up that said Andoro's coming soon. They thought, you know, we're closing and pizza place is going to come in.
A pizza place did move in last June, but Scramblers is still open. The two restaurants share a physical space and many costs, even though they have separate owners, menus, and employees. In the morning, customers can order only from the Scramblers menu, and in the evening, they can only order from Andoro's. But it's a bit more confusing at lunchtime. Even though inside the restaurant it looks and sounds more like a pizzeria with posters of Italy on the wall and the sound of soft Italian music in the background, I'm sitting here at the counter eating eggs, bacon, hash browns, and pancakes. Customers say they enjoy having the option to eat either Italian food or breakfast during lunch.
Well, variety is the spice of life, and I think that it's a good idea.
Don Dillard eats lunch here with a large group of friends every Monday. He says having pizza, pasta, and salad available on Andoro's menu gives the group more options.
A lot of people like that, too. We do have people here that eat off their menu, but I'm a breakfast person. I like their breakfast.
It's not just customers who have found there are perks with this setup. There's a benefit for the cooks, too. If one restaurant is running low on an ingredient that the other restaurant has, they'll share. The tricky part is keeping the finances separate. To help with that, each restaurant has its own credit card machine, and the computers for the wait staff allow them to ring up split tickets when customers at the same table order from both menus during lunch. Server Shervon Liston says it's easy to keep the orders for the two restaurants straight. The hard part is the timing.
You have to let the kitchen know that you're having a split ticket. Sometimes they kind of mistime it, and so breakfast kind of cooks a lot quicker than like lunch.
Even though there are still some kinks to work out, both restaurants are embracing the upside. For Andoro's owner, Tony Magliero, being able to share costs with Scramblers allowed him to break into the Springfield market.
The reason why we did it is because of the way the economy's going, and it's a lot lower, you know, startup money. As far as going by yourself, it probably would have been triple the money.
Carl Riegel teaches restaurant marketing and management at Missouri State University. He says this approach is certainly unusual.
When I first heard about it, I said, this is crazy. But then the more I thought about it, I said, well, no, it can work. But there are some pitfalls. There's accounting issues that have to be dealt with, a problem of a confused image in the public's mind about the place.
The owners of both restaurants say they don't know how long this arrangement will last, but both are willing to tough it out until the economy looks better for independent restaurants. But both are hoping at lunchtime, customers won't be too confused by the aroma of scrambled eggs mingling with the smell of fresh-baked pizza. For NPR News, I'm Missy Shelton in Springfield, Missouri.
If you have an iPhone, you already know you can use it to do almost anything, from ordering pizza to having your television record a program from across town. Now, in Boston at least, you can use your iPhone to let City Hall know what's on your mind. Boston has just launched what some might call the Killer Complainer app. NPR's Tovia Smith reports.
A few weeks ago, 41-year-old Heather Sears thought the coolest app on her iPhone was Sit or Squat, a listing of the city's cleanest, closest restrooms. But today, she's even more excited about Boston's Citizens Connect that basically lets her make a one-touch fetch about anything that's not so good in her hood.
I was thrilled to be able to walk down the alley to where I parked my car and say, all right, there's more graffiti. I want it off now. And the satisfaction of taking that picture and sending it in.
You were like armed.
I was armed and dangerous, yes.
For the 10 years she's lived in Boston's South End, Sears is the first to confess she's been a complainer, repeatedly making irate calls to City Hall about everything from potholes to broken streetlights. But now all Sears has to do is snap a picture of a problem with her iPhone. The location coordinates automatically embed in the photo, and her complaint goes hurtling through the bureaucracy of City Hall straight out to the public works crews around the city.
My graffiti picture is going to the dude who's going to go fix that graffiti, you know, directly to the dude. And that feels good.
You have hope they'll actually do something.
Yeah, I expect them to. And I'm watching. I am watching.
After a complaint is made, a red dot marks the problem on a map you can see on your iPhone. And if you keep checking, you'll see the dot turn green when your problem is fixed.
It'll be more instant gratification. I'm doing it and it's done. And I don't have to get irate when I'm finally calling the nice people at the call center.
Good afternoon, the mayor's office.
Alan Christopher has heard her share of irate at Boston's 24-hour hotline, from the guy ranting and raving about a paternity test to the countless calls about dead animals in the road, potholes that need filling, and streets that need a snowplow.
People tend to get very whiny, and naturally it's the mayor's fault.
As often as not, people calling the hotline want more than their potholes filled. As hotline staffer Frank McDonough puts it, they want a piece of you.
Sometimes it's just the venting process that makes them feel better. You know, yelling at the guy at the mayor's office, you know. So.
Oh, definitely. There's a lot of value to a human at the other end.
City officials say that won't change. Even the mayor's technology guru, Nigel Jacob, knew enough to keep a human option. Of course, for those without an iPhone, but also for those too hot-headed to use one.
We have the hot button for that. It's like, I can't, my fingers are numb with fury. I can't type. I'm just going to call.
Get me City Hall now. Okay, I need to take someone's head off.
That's right.
Or if biting someone's head off doesn't do it for you, a bit of biting sarcasm still works, even over the iPhone. The first complaint that came through the new system was one about a streetlight not working. The photo attached was solid black. Tovia Smith, NPR News, Boston.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
To know me is to fly with me. This is where I live. When I run my card, the system automatically prompts the desk clerk to greet me with this exact statement.
Pleasure to see you again, Mr. Bingham.
It's these kinds of systemized friendly touches that keep my world in orbit.
That's George Clooney in a scene from the new film Up in the Air. He's playing a business traveler who loves what most people find most alienating and irritating about travel, airports and plane rides. In a few minutes, we'll meet the director of the film, Jason Reitman, who also directed Juno and Thank You for Smoking. Up in the Air is adapted from the satirical novel by Walter Kern, who we're going to hear from first. The novel is about a business traveler who virtually lives in what he describes as Air World and has come to feel most at home there. His ambition is to earn 1 million frequent flyer miles, and he's close to achieving it. His job keeps him in the air. Companies around the country bring him in to deliver the bad news to their employees that they're being downsized out of a job. I spoke to Walter Kern in July 2001 when the book was published, just 2 months before 9/11 changed air travel. But Kern's descriptions still ring true. Our interview started with a reading.
Planes and airports are where I feel at home. Everything fellows like you dislike about them, the dry recycled air alive with viruses, the salty food that seems drizzled with warm mineral oil, the aura-sapping artificial lighting, has grown dear to me over the years, familiar, sweet. I love the Compass Club lounges in the terminals, especially the flagship Denver Club with its digital juice dispenser and deep suede sofas and floor-to-ceiling views of taxiing aircraft. I love the restaurants and snack nooks near the gates, stacked to their heat lamps with whole wheat mini pizzas and gourmet caramel rolls. I even enjoy the sweet hotels built within sight of the runways on the ring roads, which are sometimes as close as I get to the cities that my job requires me to visit. I favor rooms with kitchenettes and conference tables, and once I cooked a Christmas feast in one, serving glazed ham and sweet potato pie to a dozen janitors and maids. They ate with me in rotation on their breaks, one or two at a time, so I really got to know them, even though most spoke no English. I have a gift that way. If you and I hadn't hit it off like this, if the only words we'd passed were that's my seat, or done with that business week, or just excuse me, I'd still regard us as close acquaintances and hope that if we met again up here, we wouldn't be starting from zero as just two suits. Twice last October, I sat in the same row on different routes as 1989's Miss USA, the one who remade herself as a Washington hostess and supposedly works nonstop for voting rights. In person, she's tiny, barely over 5 feet. I put her carry-on in the overhead. But you know some of this already. You fly, too. It just hasn't hooked you. You just don't study it. Hey, you're probably the normal one.
That's Walter Kern reading from his novel, Up in the Air. Walter Kern, how did you start studying, studying airline culture?
A few years ago, I was on a plane, upgraded to first class for some unknown reason, and I sat down next to a businessman. And to make conversation, I asked him where he lived, and he said, well, right here. And I said, well, what do you mean by that? And it came out that the man had no home. He traveled on business and lived from hotel to hotel, and airplanes and airports, as in the book, were really his turf. And I asked him after a while how he managed to live like this. Wasn't it depressing and so on? And no, he seemed satisfied and even happy with his life. And after I got off the plane, I thought, now, what kind of life would that be? And over the years, I sort of filled in the blanks, and the result was this book.
Well, you've kind of defined a whole culture as air world. Describe the culture to us.
Well, air world is that conglomeration of places that are no place, including airports, the hotels that are just off the runways that serve them, the rental car counter, the whole sort of attempt to satisfy the flyer's needs without any particular offense or any particular flavor. I mean, in air world, you can come from Dallas, Minneapolis, Philadelphia, or New York and know where you are, know what's on offer, know how to get it, and what you're going to get.
And you write that the hometown papers of air world are USA Today and the Wall Street Journal.
Exactly. Everything is standardized. Everything goes down easily. It's as though the only restaurant in the world were McDonald's and the only hotel in the world was a Holiday Inn. And, you know, people have to be able to rest and feel comfortable and feel at home at any moment, at any time. And the result has been this kind of placeless place that I call Air World.
One of the things I found interesting of your whole description of air world is that in defining this culture of air world, you've taken one of the more alienating contemporary experiences, flying, an experience in which everyone is a stranger to each other on the plane and everyone is uncomfortable, and you've turned it into this community. I mean, it's not really a community, but, you know, for the purposes of this novel, it's become this, like, anti-community community.
Well, it is a community. I mean, human beings are amazingly adaptable. You bring in a new technology or you force people to live in a new environment and they find ways to do it. And my character has made friends with the people who, you know, sell the juice at the counter, the person who gives the little chair massages in the terminal. He knows the flight attendants by name. I talked to a traveler once who said, I knew I was in trouble. I knew I was flying too much when I walked through the Minneapolis airport and found myself waving to everyone.
I managed to read your novel Up in the Air while in the air in my Air Flight magazine on the same day I was reading your book. The back page, I was shocked. It had an ad for enhancing your breast size and another one for male virility enhanced guaranteed. I thought that was were kind of shocking for airline magazines.
Well, that's an odd syndrome. I think when people get on planes, they start to think about improving themselves. They start to think about and get reflective and meditative about where are they going in life? What are they doing in life? And they're prey to these ads for, like you say, you know, breast-enhancing creams and vocabulary-enhancing tape courses. And you'll see those magazines are often aimed at businessmen who are insecure about their negotiating skills, and there will be an ad for a seminar on negotiating or whatever. I think people get a sense of possibility when they're on a plane, even romantic possibility, wondering if the perfect person is going to sit down next to them or something.
Because your character is surrounded by this culture of advertising and franchise food and how-to cassettes and self-improvement mm-hmm. stuff, did you have to immerse yourself in some of that too, just so you could get all the language right?
Yeah, I did. I mean, we're immersed in it anyway. Really, all I had to do was notice how immersed I already am. Once you're alert to it and not filtering it out, it's sort of the air you breathe. And this was a book that really came about not through doing research or digging, but through waking up to the fact that I lived in this sort of miasma of messages and images, which I often felt superior to and ignored, but suddenly I decided to wake up to it. Sort of like Andy Warhol became comfortable with the cannibal soup can. You know, it wasn't as though he'd never been to a supermarket. He just suddenly looked at a supermarket and went, wait, art can happen here too.
So what were some of the things that started to strike you as interesting instead of filtering them out?
Well, one thing that struck me about Airworld is that it's a class system in a way that most of America isn't. We like to think of ourselves as a democracy and egalitarian, but you get to Airworld and there is a rating and a level for everyone. You know, you see the cards they whip out at the ticket counter. I'm a gold medallion member, or I'm a gold medallion member plus, and that entitles me to XYZ. And there are all these distinctions being made out there between types of people and better customers and, you know, the kind of pillow you're going to get or whether you'll get your glass cup or your plastic cup. And that class system in Airworld I found interesting.
Oh, it's so true. And they even call it class. I mean, it's like first class or coach class. I mean, you know what class you're in and what privileges that class allows you or what miseries
exactly.
You're in store for.
Well, I mean, the higher classes sort of allow the miseries to abate somewhat, though not disappear.
Well, shrimp cocktail will do a lot to abate misery.
Exactly. And people cling to those little perks when
That's
they're
right.
traveling in a sort of horribly pathetic way. You know, I've noticed that the few times I've traveled first class myself, you've already got your drink and your coat has been taken by the time the rest of the passengers file on. And it's hard not to feel sorry for them. They're sort of trooping past you like cows to slaughter, and you're sitting there in your, you know, wide body seat. And the funny thing about that class system is it's not really based on money. You know, some of these guys don't make more money who ride in first class. They just fly a lot, and so the airplane, the airline puts them up. And so it's the one time in their life they get to feel on top of the heap, and they take it for all it's worth.
Walter Kern recorded in July 2001 after the publication of his novel Up in the Air. A new paperback edition has just been published.